Welcome everybody to All About Symbian Insight number 124. Today is Friday the 25th of June 2010. We've got loads to get through. We have our regular crew. I'm Steve Litchfield, and with me I have...
Rafe Blanford.
And Ewan Spence.
Yes, how are you all doing, guys?
Well, looking forward to the weekend, because it feels like it's been a long week.
Yes, I'm trying to work out if I should be supporting Germany or Argentina, but other than that, I'm doing great.
Yeah, the big story of the week was probably the picking up of Nokia making some comment, I believe, in Australia, just confirming the fact that they had trailed 9 months earlier at their market day in 2009 that their strategy for MeeGo was to take the N series towards MeeGo with an extra device or two, and that the Symbian devices, apart from the N8, would basically be clustered around the X series, the E series, and the C series. And people seem to have, as usual, picked up the chance to bash Symbian and bash Nokia. And Rafe, you've put up a big analysis of your own on the site.
Yes, I mean, as you say, Steve, this has been sort of flagged for a while. I mean, I think I probably first heard of this at the MIMO Summit, and we talked about it in a podcast shortly afterwards, and it's really Nokia Capital Markets Day. I suppose the difference is here, and it's actually happened a few times now, it just happened on this occasion that it was picked up and discussed quite widely, that the N8 and its variants will be the kind of the last Symbian device amongst the N series. But as you say, there's been sort of a lot of commentary around this, some of which has perhaps not been as accurate as it could be. You know, it's the usual Symbian is doomed or dying or is a dead platform, and people making comments like, you know, why would you buy the N8 when it's a dead platform? And I think anyone who's listened to this podcast at any length of time will realise that's not the case. But just to go over the major points, it's MeeGo as something that's going to run on high-end devices, high-performance devices, which are sort of pocketable computers focused around mobile computing first, and so communications and phone is a secondary thing. And I think you can overemphasize this point, but it's really a new class of devices, which Nokia sort of beyond what their current smartphone portfolio is. I mean, arguably, this is where some of the highest-end Android and iPhone devices and the iPad sit. But and of course, the reality is it is all one continuum. But Nokia is quite clearly making a point that it sees these as a distinct class of devices from its kind of existing smartphone portfolio. It's a evolution of what N-series has always been about, which is kind of the mobile computer or as multimedia computer when it first came out. By contrast, Symbian is Nokia's smartphone platform, and that really means two things. They want to, the phrase that's been used many times is democratize the smartphone. That means take it down the cost scale so it's in the low-end and mid-tier devices. However, it's important to understand that doesn't mean that Symbian will disappear from the high-end. It's not just a mid-tier device. You know, you are going to see devices from, you know, roughly the 100 euro price point up to sort of the 450 euro price point. And indeed, Symbian will be Nokia's primary platform. They're expecting around 55% of Nokia's device net sales to come from Symbian-powered devices in 2011, for example. That sort of contrasts with Series 40 at about 30 to 35% and MeeGo at around 10%. All of these figures are, of course, you know, rough estimates. You know, to bring it into perspective, next year I'd estimate that we're going to see about 100 million Symbian sales from Nokia. I think this year we might just squeak into 100 million from Symbian overall, but certainly next year Nokia should ship about 100 million devices. That's based on kind of current shipment numbers plus a bit of growth. It's you know, fairly easy to predict. It's just worth making a few points about N-series as it stands now. As I kind of suggested earlier, it has evolved over time, and this is one of the main points I wanted to make in the article, you know, because there is often a wide perception when you speak to people outside kind of the Symbian ecosystem that Nokia Symbian devices are just N-series, and that isn't really true anymore and hasn't been for a while. Indeed, in Q1 2010, about 12% of Nokia Symbian sales were N-series devices. So clearly, switching N-series to MeeGo won't actually have that much of an impact on the sales. And indeed, that 12% is from Q1. I would imagine rather that's going to go down in Q2 and possibly Q3 as well. Maybe a slight bump up with the N8, but you know, the long-term pattern is certainly for it to go down. The big emphasis is now on Symbian devices in the C-series, the X-series, and the E-series. So as I say, as Steve suggested, you know, this isn't anything particularly new, but it is worth re-emphasizing this point that Symbian remains an extremely strong and diverse mobile platform and will be around for many years to come. So when you read sort of analyst opinions or, you know, media opinions saying that it's a dead platform, it's just not really the case. And I think it's also worth making the point, which I'm making the point, that Symbian and Mego are complementary, but I suspect Steve will want to get a word in edgeways at this point.
I just think that this whole thing has been a storm in a teacup, and I'm constantly amazed by the number of small, minor strategic decisions by Nokia, which get amplified for the purposes of slamming Symbian or just saying there are huge changes in the smartphone industry and this is the beginning of the end. And it really frustrates me in a sense. Ewan, have you got any comments on this storm in a teacup story?
Yes, war, famine, death, destruction. Nokia redoing the naming system on their handsets. It doesn't really compare, does it? What I wanted to point out in this one is that this all derived from one statement from a Nokia executive over in Australia that went around the world. And, you know, to a certain extent, I agree that Nokia haven't said anything else about it. But I really think that their PR department should have been on top of this. This was, you know, this could be a great post in the Nokia Conversations blog going, look, this is what we said. This is what we meant. We've trailed it over the last year. Nokia simply going up, here are the facts. Here are what we've said before in nice, plain black and white, rather than let it build up momentum to the point where the most sanest reaction of going in depth on it is Rafe's editorial piece from the end of last week. We've seen this happen once before with the Nokia UK guys replying to a number of issues over stolen handsets and stuff and reviews and editorials and such like. And I thought that was a really smart move by them. It's just a pity that that lesson doesn't seem to have been learned.
Yeah, I think it is wise, easy to be wise after the fact, but I suspect this, you know, the responsibility is on both sides. You know, this could have been communicated more clearly, but equally well, the media has, I believe, a certain amount of responsibility to look at the information that is available. And as we've said, this has been flagged for some time to come, and it's the spin that gets put on it that perhaps then leads to a certain amount of misinformation. You know, it's not that, Mego is replacing Symbian in the sense that a lot of people seem to think it is. You know, we are still going to see, you know, devices like the N8 running Symbian, but they are going to be tend to be classed under to different categories. You know, that'll be they'll be the high end C series, X series, and E series devices. And I think it's also important, you know, people suggest it as a replacement, whereas I think the other point I wanted to make was that Symbian and Mego should be seen as very much complementary to each other. Nokia is going to need both of them if it is to succeed. And in one sense, you know, Mego is going to be about the aspirational stuff, but the sort of big numbers, which is what Nokia is all about, are going to continue to come from the Symbian devices. And in one sense, you know, Nokia has more riding on Symbian as a platform simply because it's a greater volume, and that has implications, of course, for its obvious service offerings and things like that. But to sort of underline this point, you know, something that people need to understand, you know, there's this argument that it's bad to have two platforms. Well, I think Nokia is taking a different approach, and how successful it will be remains to be seen. But by having the single developer environment, you know, with Qt and with web runtime, this means that a large proportion of application services will be common to both platforms. And that's a big contrast to kind of existing mobile platforms, where there is something of an island effect or a siloization. You know, they don't share services and software between the two. You know, you do see developers porting across, but that's a distinct porting decision they have to make. I would say, you know, the equivalent to optimizing for the sort of Mego and Symbian is going to be similar to what developers have to do to optimize between versions of a platform on something like Android or iPhone. So this kind of Qt and web runtime offering, I think, is going to be kind of the vital bridging link, and that's all about the developer story, and that's something that Nokia hasn't always been very good at in the last few years. But, you know, developers as kind of the instigator of apps and the app gap that Nokia has is clearly something that needs to improve, and I think the signs are there.
Yeah, there's some news there this week, or last week if you're listening to the podcast. Nokia have introduced a new beta system whereby they basically pay to get developers' content Symbian signed at no cost to the developer. All the developer now has to do is, I think, register for €50 to register as an Ovi publisher, and then Nokia then pay to get any Symbian C++ or Qt content signed, all at Nokia's expense, to basically get more and more content into the Ovi store and more content into the ecosystem. Individuals can now become publishers. You don't have to be a company, which is good. And as Rafe said, the Nokia Qt SDK has been fully released, so it's all available for Windows, Linux, and Mac OS X. And Ovi Publish is now accepting Qt content for the Ovi store, so a pretty rounded set of improvements there, Rafe.
Yes, absolutely. I think actually the big one here is, as you said, the Qt SDK. That has the longest term implications, but the one that caught my interest the most was the free signing beta service or the program. It's not clear quite how widespread and how this is going to work, but I think it's going to be sort of integrated into this Ovi Publish process, and so developers will be able to upload something and get everything signed. And that, you know, clearly lowers the barriers. You know, people can get content into the Ovi store much more easily. You know, there's now a maximum cost of the €50 one-off sign-up fee, and that compares very favourably with sort of some of the other platforms. You know, Symbian signing has been, I think, a bugbear of developers. I've heard lots of complaints about it over the years. You know, it's still going to exist in the sense that developers will have to make sure that they meet the guidelines, which is a good thing, because it, you know, make sure there's a certain amount of quality within the applications, you know, so that users won't get unexpected things happening. Clearly, it's mainly about still identity Symbian signed. But as I say, the big complaints over the year has been the cost involved with Symbian signing. And for a first-time developer, that can be anything up to about $220 for their very first signing instance. And of course, you know, signing instances at sort of €10 a time for something like Express Sign do add up over time. So I think this is, you know, quite a significant move. And it hasn't perhaps been widely as reported as I was expecting, because I think this positions Nokia very well in terms of its developer offerings, because it now has both a SDK that's up to date, fast, easy to use, and I think very comparable with what you've got on Android and iPhone in the form of Qt and the Qt Mobility APIs. You've got the Ovi Store, which is still being worked on, but now developers can get into that more cheaply and more easily. It's now open to individuals, which, you know, suggests that maybe hobbyist developers will find it easier to get involved and get things happening. The Qt story, which Nokia has been talking about for, you know, getting on for 2 years now, is finally sort of maturing and getting to the point where it's the reality. Admittedly, the first devices, it's just the N97 Mini and the X6, but this will really kick in with Symbian 3. But they have said they're going to roll this back to the other devices, and something like the Qt Smart Installer, which was also released, helps with that, because it can get the legacy phones involved as well. And so what we'll see is quite a lot of the sort of older phones will also benefit from this sort of renewed application rush that will probably occur, because there'll be more interest as developers realise the opportunities, simply because the barriers to development that have existed in the Symbian world, and you can debate how big they've been and how important they've been, are gradually being removed. You know, you're not having to program in Symbian C++, which has its idiosyncrasies and has been sort of widely said to be difficult compared to some of the sort of more abstracted languages available on other platforms. You've now got the sort of a fairly seamless process of being able to get into the Ovi store, and I understand that's eventually going to be integrated into the Nokia Qt SDK as well, so it'll be a completely streamlined solution. And so it looks like, you know, all the pieces are now actually in place and actually active for this improvement to come. Clearly, it's now going to require developers to actually adopt it, and I think that'll be the next thing that Nokia will need to concentrate on, is winning developers and persuading them to have a look at the system, because there are a lot of developers out there who are just focused on iPhone and Android and consider Nokia irrelevant. And so that's kind of the next process, and I think that will take time, but it will be certainly interesting to sort of look at this in 12 months' time and see what kind of impact these changes have had.
Yeah. I was interested to see a piece from Tommy Ahonen last week, as we record this, looking at the economics of, for example, developing for things like the iPhone, which is incredibly trendy to develop for. But I think he's pointing out that there are very, very few people actually making their money back on development because of the sheer number of applications. And I do wonder that the Symbian world, with its huge, massive installed phones and the big numbers involved, actually represent a bit of a gold rush, and developers should be looking to Symbian more than iPhone. I know that goes against the grain of modern wisdom, but that's how I see it.
Absolutely, there's an opportunity there. I mean, the difficulty is Symbian perhaps has, you know, less of kind of a history of people installing and using applications. But I think that can change quite quickly. And in one sense, you know, Nokia will be able to benefit from the user education that's gone on from Android and iPhone. But I think it's a more general point is that actually making money out of mobile applications is not a simple thing. It's not as straightforward as people seem to believe it is. And the race to zero in terms of pricing on the app stores has certainly made that even more difficult. And there's, you know, quite a convincing argument to be made that there is a limited amount of opportunities in mobile applications. I mean, I sort of am quite a strong believer in the idea that, you know, there's the class of applications that are kind of feature enhancing, productivity enhancing, or entertainment focused that people are willing to pay for. And then there's the more consumable content, which makes up the vast majority of content in app stores in general at the moment, which people are kind of less willing to pay for, or at most pay 50p for. And that's very difficult to create a sustainable, I think, app economy out of. And at the moment, we don't see much distinction between those two groups. But I think we'll increasingly see those kind of consumable applications. They will still exist, but a lot of them will have to be supported by advertising, and more particularly by sort of branded approaches. And so you'll see, you know, the big brands doing these consumable content mini games to kind of push their brand across, and some of the ones who are trying to make money out of that will gradually disappear, or will transfer over to, as I say, doing these kind of branded style games. And there may be a renewed emphasis on kind of the, as I say, the feature adding, the productivity enhancing applications, and sort of games is a slightly different category. But there's a lot of evolution still left in this app store and, you know, application space. So the assumption that there is money to be made immediately is, you know, it needs a closer examination, I think.
Yeah, I was absolutely fascinated by the topic of how you set price levels for applications. I was talking to SPB CEO yesterday. Well, we did an interview with him for the site and for the phone show in London. And I put the question to him, you know, why are SPB's applications so expensive? They range from sort of £5 right up to about £30, depending on which one you go for. And his answer was pretty similar. So myself, when I was setting the price for some of my shareware programs back in the 1990s, I was pitching my programs at about £10 or £12. And the answer is, if you price them too low, it simply becomes a non-profit making venture, because by the time you've factored in all the support and admin and processing of any purchasing, you're not making any money at all. And at the end of the day, these companies are in it to make money. Absolutely. So he said that, look, we cannot make money unless we pitch our programs at £10 or more. Yes, if you could guarantee us 4 or 5 times the sales by halving the price, we'd do it. But the actual reality is you might only get 50% more sales, we'd end up losing money. I find it fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the classic economics of the price demand curves, where that it's sometimes better to sell fewer of something that's priced at a higher price. The trouble is, of course, finding that optimal point is not straightforward, and developers do have to tend to experiment in order to see what reducing the price, or indeed increasing the price, does to their sales. And I think there is scope for more information for developers on that. And, you know, for any developers listening to this, we'll be interested to hear how that you actually decide these pricing levels, and whether you've done any experiments to try and optimize the pricing point in terms of maximizing your revenue.
It reminds me very much of Ben Vaughan back in the Scion days with his whole bundle of shareware. Now, he did pretty much purely games, and they were both very expensive, and also the demos of them, they only ran for maybe about 30 seconds, a minute or 2 minutes. And I remember asking him at the time, you know, why are your demos so short? Why don't you let people play the games a little bit longer before buying? And his answer was, whenever I release demos that have a much longer time of playing, less people buy them, which seemed, you know, it seemed intuitive and counterintuitive at the same time. And nowadays, there are so many light versions in application stores of almost a full game. I think there was one management game which you had to play for 4 hours before you hit the shareware limit, and said, would you mind now going off and paying 99p? And it just didn't work. You know, it doesn't work. The assumption that many people are making that you have to sell huge amounts at 50p, well, you know, for a hobby developer, they're going to need, you know, gross income of maybe about 1,500 euros, pounds, dollars, whatever. Far easier to sell 100 things at £15 in this market than sell 1,500 things at a penny each. So it's, you know, the developer story that everybody believes in now, that race to the bottom is being the only way. If you have to get volume, have to get sales, you know, it would be nice to see other stories being told. And this is where the Ovi blog can come in useful. They can go to applications. Yeah. So look, these applications are at £10 a time. They're not selling many of them, but they're selling a living wages worth of applications. They need to portray those options. You know, having, you know, three rating stars and they're all 99p, 1 euro, 1, 2 or 5. It's just, you know, we need to hear more stories. We need to hear more press. We need to hear more marketing. And Nokia needs to make it easy for these stories to come out, which goes back to my first point, which is, okay, it's great. Nokia have said all these things before, but they could have taken this opportunity to go over their NCU strategy again and make it easy for the journalists to find their side of the story and get it out.
Yeah, no, I think you're right there, Ewan. And I think it's worth emphasizing this point, you know, this isn't a homogeneous situation. There are going to be multiple models that work. But perhaps what's interesting here is I feel that the very structure of app stores as they currently stand sort of predictate the sort of race to the bottom as being the way to do it because
Agreed.
Of the way that, you know, optimization and positioning in app stores work. And the first manufacturer that can actually find a way around that and sort of sort out application discovery and create kind of a rich connection between the users, which all of them have talked about at various times, will have a significant advantage because not only will they attract users who are able to find the applications they want more easily, perhaps even more critically, developers will be keener to go to that platform, that app store, because they'll be able to make money more easily. And so that's the thing to watch in app stores. And I think, you know, the metrics that people look at the moment in terms of number of applications and sales can be a little bit misleading because there's an awful lot of innovation left in that app store space, and it'll be really interesting to see who can make the movements there first.
Yeah. I'm still reminded of applications like Gravity, which is a common example, but it still stands the test of time. And people have said to Jan-Elisa, who wrote it, why on earth don't you reduce the price from £8? It's too expensive. But the fact is that provides him with a living wage and a realistic wage that he can actually keep going. And more to the point, I'm fully of the opinion that applications should delight the user so that you actually want to pay money. And for example, in Gravity's case, you get to use it, you flick around in the interface, you think this is wonderful. How can I, you know, if it's a demo, how can I register? I want to register right now, never mind the 30 days. I want to get this program. I want to own it. I want to reward the developer. And in actual fact, for something that you're going to use for hour after hour, day after day, then £8 really is neither here nor there. Phone Torch 2 is another little example. It was released a couple of months ago, actually, under very little fanfare and no one noticed it. But basically, the S63rd edition feature pack 2 phones, like the N86 I've got here, use the dual LEDs as a genuine flashlight. And it works very slickly, works very quickly, and it's about £2 or £3. And again, you fire it up for the very first time, you think, wow, this is just so slick. I want to pay for it right now. I want to reward the developer. And as a tip along those lines, if you do want to buy Phone Torch 2, then if you get it from the developer, I think it's €2. If you get it from the Ovi store, it's £3. So despite what I said about rewarding the developer, you can actually save money if you want to save the extra quid by buying it directly from the developer. So, but the idea of rewarding developers is actually critical, because if you don't reward the developers, they go out of the ecosystem and you lose them forever. And I was part of it in the science scene, so that's you and I both changing the science jar this week, back in the 1990s. And I was very enthusiastic in the science community. My programs were premium prices. I think Mapper was £15. And yet I had 3,000 people register it over a four-year period at £15 because they tried it and they thought, wow, I want to reward the developer and I want to be part of the ecosystem. I want to see him carry on to do more programs. And that's how it should be.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same, really.
Absolutely. Talking of things changing, on to some other news, though. Let's move on from this topic. Nokia's Ovi Suite has got an update to version 2.2, adding simplified navigation. And they keep tweaking the way the panes and the menus work. There's now Office 2010 support, which is rather more important. There's also support for new devices and a new full-screen photo and video viewer. Whoopee! So bit by bit, they're integrating more of the things that were add-ons in the previous PC suite into the one all-singing, all-dancing Ovi suite. And as before, I say they have now improved performance to the level where I do recommend this over the standalone PC suite. It's certainly a lot neater to just tell people, look, download Ovi suite. It's got all the bits you need, including maps downloading and firmware updating and so on. So it is a 70 megabyte download, but that's neither here nor there. It works very well, and I've now updated my PC. The Obvious Store has also had a refresh and a new client. There's a new client version 1.07, and you get the continuous pages for content lists. So basically, when you rather than having to tap on more items and then get a new page of items, you tap on more items, and iPhone or Android style, it basically adds the next page of matches to your search or your to your browse list, adds it to the bottom, so you get a longer kinetically scrolled list. This is good because it means you get to see the full context and the full range of apps. It's bad because when you drill down into an application and see the details and screenshots and reviews, you then go back and you're back at the top of the list. And if this was a list of five or six screens all appended together, you then have to scroll right down to the very bottom again, and this becomes a right royal pain. So 10 out of 10 for trying the idea, Nokia, but how can you please fix it so you go back to the same point in the list as you were when you started? There are also some changes behind the scenes to the Obvious Store in terms of metadata for the applications. So Rafe, how does that work?
Well, this is just something that developers need to be aware of, and it will come out in later versions of the Obvious Store. For example, keywords are now being used in the search indexes. There's also mood tags. These are all aimed at sort of improving the kind of the discovery of applications by providing extra metadata. In theory, the idea is that search will work better because there'll be more things to search against. It's also the idea of being able to include extra screenshots. And, you know, it's really this idea of optimizing your positioning in the any app store by providing extra metadata. There's also things like the support email addresses are going to be made public or made viewable in a future version of the Obvious Store. I suspect this is about Nokia wanting to try and pass on some of the support directly to developers rather than have users emailing them with the problems that they're having with their applications. And there's quite a few things like that. I think, as I say, the key ones are really around the keywords and the sort of the mood tags. These will improve search, and indeed search has improved in this new client. It's able to recognise more partial strings. I think we've said quite a few times we still feel that's one of the weak aspects of the Obvious Store search in particular, and sort of discovery of applications. But this is something that developers need to pay attention to, and it's all in the Ovi Publish tool, which has now been updated with the sort of most recent release of sort of Ovi Store and Ovi Publish. So I'd advise them to go and check it out in more detail.
Yeah. Other news this week, and this is rather topical, but totally non-Symbian related, but hopefully it will lead into some Symbian ecosystem discussion in terms of hardware. The Apple iPhone 4 came out yesterday as we record this, and there's a bit of an issue people have found with the much-vaunted building the radio antennae into the stainless steel band around the phone. And people have found, just to summarise the problem, that when you hold the device in your left hand, as you will if you're a right-hander, which is 85% of the population across the world, then the capacitance and the conductance in your skin then shorts out the two antenna, and you lose all your signal, and you then can't make phone calls or have mobile data. So that's a bit of a gotcha. So Ewan, how bad a problem is this, and can we learn anything from this for the Symbian ecosystem?
How bad is it is an interesting question. Evidence is still being gathered. Let's be honest, though, every manufacturer, rather than gloating, is probably going there, but for the grace of God, go I. Most mobile phones have their antenna at the bottom and on the left as you're looking at the device, simply because when you're holding it in the normal position, that puts the aerial as far away from the head as possible. So all the radiation searches and scans and everything, it keeps the impact as low as possible. You know, I think the thing is they've put it on the outside, and people know that when you grab onto an aerial, it changes what happens to the reception. You can find this on a car radio, just put your hand out and hold onto the aerial. You can do it at home. It's a basic physics thing. There were some raised eyebrows when an Apple went, oh, and the aerial is right round the outside of the device. And, you know, I saw that and thought, oh, great. So they put it around the device and they put the shielding around the outside as well. They've kept it outside of the electronics. That's great. Turns out there isn't any shielding on that as well. It's the actual physical aerial, which is just weird. I don't know whether it's a design flaw or whether they've just tested it wrong or whether they've been using it in cases around the office so that it never made that connection. But in true British fashion, we've already discovered how to fix it. You just get a bit of sticky backed plastic about 2 inches long and stick that along the edge of the phone, and there you go. I mean, look, every manufacturer has problems at launch. I mean, Nokia have had one with GPS antennas and lens covers that all of a sudden you go from maybe 100 people testing the hardware to, you know, a couple hundred thousand people testing the hardware. and things happen. It's the nature of putting in lots of electronics into a very small space. I'm not going to gloat over Apple's hardware problems because that is not fair. I might have a strange look at the PR reception it's getting, but in terms of hardware, it's a sticky one, and I'm going to be intrigued to see what happens next.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there, Ewan. I mean, people, I think, you know, almost gloating on this too much, because I feel quite sorry for Apple here, that mistakes like this do happen. You know, you can debate, as Ewan suggests, the response to it, but I think people probably don't necessarily appreciate just how complex this aerial engineering is. And admittedly, you know, it's not the first time that the iPhone has been cited for things, you know, with slightly dodgy reception or dropped calls. But this is because, you know, Apple doesn't necessarily have the same traditional strength that a company like Nokia or Sony Ericsson or Motorola has in this area. And, you know, when you're talking about pentaband 3G radios, the sort of the physics going on and the sort of complex interaction between the various bands and the way things work, and as you say, picking it up in the hand, are quite complicated. So it is something that is worth learning, I think, here from any manufacturer, is this sort of thing is, you know, vitally important. But at the same time, I suspect this is going to be fixed fairly rapidly in the form of sort of a modified design. We won't necessarily see it announced as such, but, you know, typically there are design tweaks that go on maybe just after a device has been released. So I think what this we should really take from this is the complex engineering that goes into these products these days, rather than, you know, any particular, you know, negative strike against Apple. These things happen sooner or later to everybody. And so I'm actually slightly surprised to see Apple being quite so strongly castigated. I mean, it's, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but these things do happen. And so you have to sort of have a little bit of perspective on it.
Indeed. I mean, it's part of this almost celebrity culture of build them up and knock them down coming on here. To put this into a bit more perspective, everybody probably remembers the toy walkie-talkies they had as a kid. And you could maybe go about 10 meters away from the other person and then you would lose radio reception. The aerials in modern smartphones have a range of about 10 miles in some cases for voice calls all the way out, even though, you know, they like to put cells and groups much closer together for better coverage. They can go 10 miles off that little tiny battery. There's a huge amount of physics and engineering here, and, you know, the fact that you can fix it just by putting a bit of sticky tape over it means that maybe they just need to get a different polish or a different varnish that goes on it the next machines. The people that bought it originally, okay, Apple are going to take a hit and they're going to provide them the $30 slip case, which probably costs them about $5 to manufacture. So there'll be a nice bit of goodwill and PR coming out here. And what you can guarantee is that Apple will spin a brilliant PR story out of this. That's what I expect to see. They're going to spin this round to advantage. People are going to go, oh, look at that. They build a Dove phone and everybody gives them a good time about it. That never happens with any other manufacturers. No, it's because their PR department managed to take it and spin it round into a good thing, and I seem to have a running theme happen this week already. These things are difficult. Let them fix it, then we'll rip the phone to shreds at a software and a hardware level, but not for manufacturing fault. No.
Yeah, I can't just imagining the scene, actually, that Nokia and Sony Ericsson and Samsung are much stronger in the telephony side of things. And I just imagine some design person at Nokia rushing into the manager saying, hey, we've got a new design for you. We've got the aerial on the outside. And the people,
stop! Like, what are you doing? No!
Are you crazy? You can't have users' hands touching the aerial. So I think that's rather a basic engineering design flaw. And you have to. People have said about the iPhone 4 prototypes being out in iPhone 3GS alike mock-up cases, so people couldn't spot them in use. And you have to feel that that was partly to blame, that these were shielding the test engineers' hands from the aerials and giving them an artificial sense of security and safety. But it's amusing, but there are also lessons to be learned. And let's not forget that some Nokia models, in particular, I think the E71, the antenna placement was distinctly non-optimal. And if you hold that particularly tightly, just the sheer shielding of the hand then knocks the signal bars down by two or three. So it's not entirely Apple's A few more quick bits of news. The Sports Tracker shop has opened. For a start, you can now buy the Polar Bluetooth heart monitor, which is something that people have been ogling for a couple of years now. It's been limited to just the shipping with the Nokia N79 Active. You can now buy your own one. I think it's €70, which is expensive-ish, but if it's something you're going to use every day, every week to monitor your heart and enhance your sports tracker use, then that's a jolly good thing. Also, I gather you and you can now do more stuff at the Sports Tracker website.
Yes, they're slowly opening up the facilities on this one. You can, as well as pre-registering your username if you were doing that before, you can also get the data from the Nokia Sports Tracker server onto the Sports Tracker website. Because they're a separate company, you need to give them specific permission to do that. You can do that now. Nokia's going to switch their side of the server off on June the 30th, but you'll still be able to move the data over up until the end of August. So there's a nice long period of running to get everything going. I have to say, Sports Tracker was still one of my favorite applications. I'm looking forward to see how much difference my cycling and walking happens during the Edinburgh Fringe, which happens in August, compared to now.
And I did have a quick word with the Sports Tracker guys about this, and they say that the sort of online service, they're working hard on it and will release it as soon as possible. So I imagine we'll see that in the next month or two, to sort of take over from the fact that Nokia Sports Tracker Beta is closing. But you and Steve, this is one of the applications I'm something of a fan of, so I'm glad to see this service getting the attention it deserves.
Yeah. Final news item. I gather there's a conspiracy afoot. Ewan, can you explain?
Yes, indeed. There seems to be lots of references to an event that happened in 1966 as if it's going to happen again. But I suspect you're talking about the one from Nokia and the guy from Heroes instead, aren't you? Heroes, Tim Krieg, who wrote the Hit American stuff that just looked like a comic book series, has been working with Nokia to do their latest game, which mixes software and actual location-based gaming with heats and things happening around London from the middle of July through till August. It's not the first time Nokia have been involved in actual reality gaming. The Nokia game happened at the turn of the century, which basically anybody could enter, and you eventually got down to like five or six people in a knockout round taking place in the real world. The same thing is happening here. The game Exclusion, which we reviewed recently, was one part of the conspiracies. There's now a Blackwell Books or some great big bad based in London, and you can pretend to break into their supercomputer to get clues and hints to what you have to do. There's other things being dotted around. The website is conspiracyforgood.com, and you can head to there. If you are taking part, you do need to make sure, I suspect you'll need to make sure that you're able to get to London for the end of July for whatever great big grand final showdown that they're going to have you do. But certainly watching this with interest. It's a different way of, guess what, telling a story.
And with that, we're going to tell the story of the Insight podcast, which is just about to finish. You can find out more about us, of course, on allaboutsymbian.com. There are our Twitter accounts. If you're into Twitter, it's a great way to follow us and what we're up to in our innermost thoughts day to day, at Rafe Blandford, at Steve Litchfield, don't forget the T in Litchfield, and at Ewan, just E-W-A-N. But for now, we've run out of time, so it's goodbye from me, and it's also
goodbye from me.
And it's also goodbye from me, and Z5578 is not a conspiracy for good clue.